Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Take a Stab at It. I'm your host, John Hoyer, and with me is...
Jason Bartsch, the ever-charismatic Jason Bartsch.
Don't get too cocky, buddy.
What's going on, fellow stabbies?
Get off my podcast.
No good?
You know.
I'm trying it out. I think it's going to catch on.
Yeah. Okay.
I really do.
Yeah, you think it'll catch on? Okay.
All right, so episode one in the books. How you feeling so far?
Feeling pretty good. The reaction to it has been whelming. Not underwhelming, not overwhelming.
Just the regular amount of whelming.
Just, yeah.
Well, that's good. I've been filled with, I don't want to say crippling self-doubt, but, you know.
Excellent. This is a great start to another episode. All right. So what we're going to do today is we're going to be doing a what we've been watching segment, and then we will start talking about the start of our cult films miniseries, and then conclude with a review of The Seventh Victim.
Yes, indeed.
All right. So Jason, let's start off. What have you been watching lately?
So my sisters actually told me about this movie on Netflix called The Platform. It's pretty interesting. It takes place in this kind of dystopian future, and prisoners are housed in this kind of chamber with hundreds and hundreds of levels, and it's just them and a roommate. Basically, what happens is level one is the highest level. And they start with a platform full of food, just like the most scrumptious food you can imagine, like five-star dining. And basically, they get to eat their share. Every level has maybe a minute or two to eat. And after that time, the level lowers to the next level, and then lowers and lowers. So the people on level 100 are getting the leftovers of 99 people. You know, it's kind of a political allegory, I guess, kind of, you know, about if everyone just would take their share, there'd be enough to go around for everybody. So it's really interesting. You know, there's a lot of kind of conflict on the lower levels, you know, when food is running low. And what's interesting is every month in this prison, you wake up on a different level. So you could fall asleep on level 8, and then the next month you could be on like level 200. So it's pretty interesting. It reminds me a lot of Snowpiercer, kind of a similar concept. So yeah, that's one I checked out recently. I'd recommend it.
All right. So any other things you want to talk about for what you've been watching?
That's all I got today. What have you been watching, John?
All right. So I saw a little movie called Commando, the 1987.
You're good with years, John. I'm gonna check you on this.
All right. It's an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, and for years I haven't watched it, even though I love
85.
Yeah, I'm actually a little embarrassed. I was that far off.
That's a lot for you to be off. Do you want to start the podcast over?
Okay, so it's gonna bother me the rest of the episode. I love like Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, some of my favorites, Predator, Terminator movies, you know, but I had never seen Commando until this week. And as far as I knew, everyone was saying, oh, it's so bad it's good. And I tend to think, when someone says it's so bad, it's good, it's just bad, bad.
Sure.
So I watched it, and it is kind of amazing. Every character talks in, like, cheesy 1980s one-liners. So, like, it's the most, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, like, out there. Every step of the way, for some reason, the story goes in a direction you think is... well, they would never choose that because that's stupid, but they choose it, and it's actually secretly brilliant. And I feel bad that I haven't seen this until now, because if me
I'm
being
surprised this isn't one of those films that you saw when you were like 8 years old, like Die Hard. I thought your parents might have had a double feature, Commando and Die Hard.
Listen, I would have loved seeing Commando. The next thing I was going to talk about, I played The Last of Us Part 2.
Okay.
And not sure when this episode will be coming out, so this will maybe seem a little dated. But for me, John Hoyer, it takes me like, I don't know, 2 years to beat a game, you know, due to sheer incompetence. But I managed to beat...
Okay, I can get on board with that.
So I ended up playing Last of Us Part 2, and I beat it in about like a week and a half.
Really? So, you beat the whole game?
Yeah. I mean, on easy mode, but yes. Listen, the bad guys are easier to kill, but I still have to figure out where to go. I love when you choose what modes, like they say like normal, easy, and then for easy, they tell you for, you know, if you haven't played a video game before. So... So I was like, I've only been playing games my whole life, but yeah, no.
So I'll tell you what's a step under easy mode. My wife has been watching YouTube videos of people playing The Last of Us Part 2 for hours at a time. And I personally can't get in that mindset. I know there's certainly a market for it. Those videos have a tremendous amount of views. But
yeah, I don't get it.
I think it's similar to how kids nowadays watch YouTube videos of other children playing with toys that they want. And sometimes the kids don't even want the toys. They just want to watch other kids play with the toys. So I told my wife, I was like, I will buy you this game. She was like, oh, no, I don't want to play it. silly me to assume.
Oh, Jason, come on.
Would want to play it. She says she's too scared. So okay. I don't know.
Well, so my sister actually was telling me that her students, she's a teacher, her students will go on YouTube and find YouTube videos of other like kids studying or doing homework. They'll play it on the in the background, and then they'll like read and do homework. And then when I guess the other person's done, you know, whatever, done doing their homework, they'll like be like, okay, that's enough homework for me for like doing an hour of homework or something. And
what?
And I was like, that's serial killer shit. What is that?
Yeah, what? Wait, so they're doing their own homework while they watch someone else do unrelated homework.
I guess it's to get them in the mindset of like, you know, like if you're like at the library, someone else's people are reading and being quiet. So like they'll have that on in the background. That someone's sitting there reading, and then they'll feel like they're in that mood as well, I guess. I don't know.
My favorite part of leaving school is that I didn't have to be around the kids I went to school with. And kids are voluntarily welcoming these strangers into their room to do homework with them over YouTube.
Oh, man, I can't go to the library. How can I make my room feel like a library?
So when the YouTube video is done, that they're just done with their homework, regardless of where they are?
So my sister wasn't clear on that, but it sounded
I'd like to hear more. Could you report back to me on that? Yeah, next episode.
Okay.
We're going to come back to this.
All right. Moving things along, back to Last of Us. So I played through the first game a few years ago, but took me a long time to beat it, whatever. The new one comes out. I made sure I downloaded the game at like a few days before it was available. So the download's done. It's just like a little clock that's ticking down to the, you know, Friday at 12 a.m. for it to, you can play it.
Okay.
So I'm playing at 12 o'clock. I start playing it. This is very uncharacteristic of me, folks. Jason can attest
sure
to this. This is not something I normally do, but I really love the story of the games and whatever. But so I'd say about like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, there was something that I was like a little stuck on. And I go to look it up, see if anyone, where everyone else is at, because, you know, first few hours that it's available, maybe there's not going to be a lot online about it. No, I'm wrong.
Had beaten the game already.
No, so they actually, there were spoilers that were leaked because there are people that hated the story or something. I don't know. But like, I guess a lot of other like streamers and stuff, the people that Sadie watches, got the game early. So like they like were playing through the game already, or they already did it a few days ago. And there's all these YouTube videos of stuff. And I'm like, I am behind everyone, even though I've been playing for the last like 4 or 5 hours and it's only been available for 4 to 5 hours. I would think there's no conceivable way that I could be spoiled online with the ending or something. I was wrong. No, they spoiled it.
And, so you knew how it ended.
Well, there's a lot of context of like how it gets there. So like
it didn't totally ruin it for you.
It didn't, because I was like reading something. I was like, they're like mentioning characters I don't know. So like it all blended together, because I didn't know like these characters' names and whatnot that come up later on in the game.
But I know you. You were probably still a little pissed, right?
Oh, absolutely. I waited years to play this game. Long story short, I did really enjoy the game. It's really smart. The graphics are amazing. It's
This is becoming long story long, John.
All right. Let's move on then. Last week, we were discussing how we were going to be starting a mini series, and we're going to be talking about cult films. Not films that have a cult following, but films that deal with cults themselves. And when we were discussing what kind of podcast we're going to be doing, what films we can be talking about, we both kind of noticed that we had a fascination with films that had dealt with cults. I think you and I both have been pretty big fans of Midsommar. You mentioned some other films that you liked. So what is it about cults that you find so fascinating?
So I was thinking about this. I think cult films kind of, they really allow for a slow burn horror film, which is something that I know you and I both really appreciate when done properly and when done well.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, just to kind of watch the psychological breakdown of a character who is kind of watching their reality slip away. I just think that's really fascinating. And the whole genre itself is kind of a playground for the man versus society story conflict, as well as the man versus himself story. So I think there's parts in cult films where those two conflicts kind of converge. What's fascinating to me, I think, is how a lot of these films are kind of, we're watching them through the eyes of the outsider.
Yeah.
So we're kind of learning about this cult as they do.
Yeah. So, it's kind of like a counterculture that we're being introduced to, that there's in some ways an allure to it, while also being something that is maybe scary, weird, uncomfortable, you know, whatever.
It's kind of the horror version of like the fish out of water genre, which I think a lot of people can relate to, which I find very interesting.
Absolutely.
So the film we're talking about today is The Seventh Victim. The quick synopsis of this film is basically a young woman named Mary learns that her sister in New York has gone missing, and she's no longer paying for Mary's boarding school tuition. So Mary heads to New York in search of her sister, only to discover that her sister has become deeply involved in a satanic cult. So I think kind of right off the bat, this might sound like kind of a boilerplate plot, but you got to keep in mind this was the 1940s, correct? 42, 43?
43, I believe.
So you didn't often see a lot of satanic cults on screen in this era, if ever, correct?
As far as I can tell from what I was reading, there has never been anything that has been overtly stated to be a satanic cult before this film.
Okay.
Well, in keeping with what you were talking about, I think maybe it might be important to give a little bit of a historical context to the release of this film and what led up to it. So if you'll indulge me for a minute as I look at my notes that I wrote for this, because I'm a fancy boy.
You watched YouTube videos of other people taking notes while you did this, right? Oh, that's a fine point, Penn. I hadn't even thought of that.
I hope everyone finds this as funny as us. All right. Well, okay. So this film was released by RKO Pictures. For those that don't know, RKO is mostly known as being the studio that released Citizen Kane, which is arguably considered one of the greatest movies of all time. But that movie, while being a critical success, was a huge financial failure. Orson Welles directed that and then went on to make The Magnificent Ambersons, which was also a box office failure. This led to the studio losing about $2 million in that time period, which by today's standards doesn't seem that much, but for them, they were almost like on the edge of financial ruin.
So why do you think movies like that were failures in that era? Like movies that have become so, you know, renowned in this day and age. Like what do you know? Like what were people gravitating towards in that era?
Well, so it's interesting because I think that sometimes when a movie is a little ahead of its time, that it takes us a while to kind of catch on that this was this was something special.
And we that still happens today. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting, Magnificent Ambersons, they actually reshot part of it and re-edited the movie behind Orson Welles' back. The tragedy of it is actually that the original cut that Orson did, it's not available anywhere. So we only have this truncated, I think, 80 something minute version of the movie. And I mean, in my opinion, it's really good. It's not as good as Citizen Kane, but I can only imagine if I could see a world where it was the original version could have been better than Citizen Kane. So
we can only watch the 80 minute version that film.
I think it's like 88 minutes or something.
Wow. How does Val Lewton, producer of The Seventh Victim, kind of play into this whole time period?
Okay, so at this time, the head of RKO was let go and they put someone else, another man, in charge. And their first thought was, how can we make money as quick as possible? So they looked at Universal and the success of the Universal monster movies and saw an opportunity there. So they hired a man named Val Lewton, who he wasn't known to audiences, but he was the assistant to David O. Selznick, who was kind of a known producer of like important like literary adaptations like Anna Karenina, A Tale of Two Cities, Gone with the Wind.
Okay.
So Val Lewton was like this guy who would do all the research for these movies, the historical research, and he did all of the not easy jobs of like making a movie. It was like he would be told to, hey, take care of this.
Right.
So eventually RKO, you know, they heard good things about him. So they reached out to him and like, hey, we need you to head our horror department. I actually have a little list here of what the rules were for him, which were, so you make these movies, but they have to be under $150,000 per movie, and each movie has to run under 75 minutes long. The studio would give him the titles of the movies. The rest was up to him. So he was in charge of hiring all the crew, the directors, the writers, everything. RKO had no, like, they didn't care.
Wait, so they literally just said, this is what your movie's called, make a movie?
Yes.
No script or anything?
No, they're just like, hey, you're going to make a movie called Cat People. Figure it out.
Wow. So like he could like go to work one day and they're like, all right, here we have a walrus in space. Like go to town. Like,
yeah.
So he had no idea. That's pretty baffling.
They would basically just have to run and gun, shoot what they can, and they would have tight production schedules. And if they're doing something that's like a little atmospheric, they couldn't have shots that would linger too long or anything too fancy in terms of production. But it did allow them to make stories that were a little bit outside the mainstream. Val Lewton was somebody who, from my research anyway, it seemed that he was someone who was a little bit more of a melancholy kind of person who seemed to have some bouts of depression. And he was also someone with a high amount of work ethic. He would go through the final script and rewrite it until he felt like it was good enough to film. I guess what I kind of find inspiring about the whole thing was just that he seemed like somebody who nothing was good enough, you know, that he wanted to keep working hard and delivering something of value, even though his higher ups were more about the bottom line and like.
It sounds like they're more about quantity than quality.
So with his first film, Cat People, I think it was about $143,000 was what it cost.
So he was under budget.
Yeah. So, and then after it was released, I think it made something between like $1 million, $1.5 million. So
oh,
he was like the talk of the town about like, wow, like he was able to make that
huge
kind of money. Yeah. And borderline, I mean, you could argue single-handedly saved the studio at the time period.
So it sounds like he did the best under the circumstances with the limitations that he had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, 150,000 in the 40s, it looks like, you know, that's, you know, just shy of 3 million, which isn't a lot to make a, you know, a studio feature film nowadays.
It almost feels like a little bit of a prototype to like the Blumhouse thing, but
yeah,
to be more accurate though, it would have to be like Jason Blum writing the final scripts for every movie and then going crazy and having two heart attacks, making sure that they're acceptable. But like, I find it endlessly fascinating. I almost would like it if maybe someone made a movie about this guy.
So The Seventh Victim, it's a film about a cult. It's a horror film. It's a mystery. It's sort of a love story. I guess we'll get to that.
Yeah. yes, it is.
So I don't know. I guess let's get into that a little bit. Like, what are your thoughts on this film overall?
It's interesting because initially, as I was watching it, just I was seeing it, trying to see it through the prism of like movie about a cult. And as time went on, I kind of realized that the cult itself is not really a big part of the story till like the end.
Yeah, not at all. They don't.
Yeah,
it's barely mentioned. You know, there's a couple scenes here and there. Even at the end, I don't think, you know, they even spend a ton of time on it.
Yeah, so at first watching it, I was a little confused on even categorizing it as a horror film, to be honest.
Right.
Because it's more of a mystery noir for about half the movie. Mm-hmm. And then when Mary starts uncovering things and events start occurring, then you start getting some pretty nice low-key lighting, atmospheric visuals that I started to key into it more. When it stopped being so talky and was more trying to present things in a visual sense, I got on board with it.
Yeah, I thought the atmosphere worked really well. What'd you think of the shower scene that was kind of, you know, I guess it's kind of a prelude to, you know, the now famous shower scene from Psycho. You know, our main character's kind of, you know, she's taking a shower and then one of the leaders of the cult kind of comes in to talk to her, and she's silhouetted. And if you watch back, you know, it almost looks as if she has devil horns through the shower curtain.
So yeah, it's interesting. As soon as that scene started, I was like, where is this going? I'm like, mm-hmm. As a Hitchcock fanboy, I was like, wait, this is where it came from? This is so cool.
Yeah.
Like,
was that referenced or attributed at all to Psycho, or is that coincidental?
From what I read, it sounds like people do attribute that Hitchcock was inspired by this scene for Psycho, but I haven't seen like anything where Hitchcock himself said it, but it's really, it'd be a very weird coincidence. It doesn't seem like it was a coincidence.
You know, he shot through a shower curtain to show the silhouette of this really evil character, I guess, and then shot back through the shower curtain to kind of show our main character, Mary, kind of trapped and, you know, out of focus. And I don't know.
It's an interesting scene because it also, it makes you think about the fact that you do feel very vulnerable in a shower. Mm-hmm. Like if there's some sort of risk or worry of something happening, there's nowhere for you to go. You are trapped, as you were saying. Woman's name, the character's name was Mrs. Reddy, kind of warns her to stop her investigation into what was happening to Mary's sister.
It's very foreboding, that moment. That's kind of you know, that's I think the one of the first moments in the film where, you know, you kind of realize that this woman's more of a threat.
I love the can-do attitude of this film and it trying to give some visual flair, I guess, to...
Nowadays, we kind of take for granted the show don't tell theory in films. And, you know, in the 40s, that wasn't really the case. So it was a little outside the box to do the things that he was doing. And I think that's just one example of, you know, how he worked with the limitations that he had making these pictures.
So the movie is, I think, 72 minutes, I think. So it is a short film. It does, I think, relative to the time period, it does move at quite a good pace, but it is front loaded with a lot of like longer scenes in like the first half. And then as things develop and things are uncovered, I feel like it really kind of comes alive in the second half of the film. So overall, I'm pretty positive on it. Jason, what would you say your thoughts on the film were?
Yeah, I would agree. I think it got stronger at the end. I think once you kind of realize you're dealing with a cult around the halfway point or so, it kind of takes you in a little bit more. I would have liked to have seen more time spent with the cult. You know, right now, I feel like it's very surface level, like, oh, it's a satanic cult. And I don't know, I'm always fascinated with the inner workings of these cults, but at the same time, 75 minutes doesn't leave you a lot of time to get to that. So I get that. I understand where he's coming from. Some things did kind of feel half realized to me. There was this kind of stretch of a love story where Mary's sister, who she's searching for, she's married Jacqueline. To this guy. Yeah, Jacqueline is Mary's sister. So Jacqueline is married to this guy who helps Mary find her. And throughout this film, I guess he falls in love with Mary. And supposedly at the end, she's in love with him too. I didn't get that. I'm all about a well-placed romantic subplot, but this was not one of them. And I said to you, you know, before the show, I said it felt like they were missing scenes, and you were like, incidentally, they were. So
yeah, they actually cut out, there are four scenes that were cut out of the movie to shorten it. And you can tell, because there's parts where it's like, there's a one shot, it's like it fades into the outside of a morgue, and then it fades to a lawyer's office, and you're like, wait, what happened? And then Mary goes in and explains that, you know, she went into the morgue and they told her that this guy Ward was calling about Jacqueline there. I'm guessing to like move the plot along, they're like, well, we already explained what she restates, like what we just saw the scene before. So let's just cut the scene out. It has that. And it's a bit weird how they transition like that. And in regards to the relationship, a lot of the movie, Ward is not believing Mary about any of the crazy stuff she sees.
Yeah.
And he's like telling her, drink your milk. And she's like, don't you tell me what to do. And he goes, I'll never tell you what to do. And then he's like, the next thing he says is like, anyway, I know this lady who's looking for a kindergarten teacher. Want a job? And she goes, yeah, sure. And then I could get an apartment at this place. And the scene moves on, but it's like, he kind of, instead of telling you what to do, he's like pushed you, like said, hey, this is the thing you might want to do.
Yeah. No, I never
strongly suggested, you know,
I never got the vibe that she was into him. There was this poet character that I think you and I both kind of felt she was sweet on.
Yeah. Hoag.
Yeah. And like Jason didn't Hoag. Really, that didn't really pan out. Jason didn't get the girl.
No. No. Well, in real life, that happened, so. Because you're married, and I know this. I know
that you do know this. You found it out in the last episode.
Oh, that's a good callback. Sorry, guys. I'm impressed with myself. No, yeah, so, like, Jason is, like, this poet guy, and he's, like, he seems pretty sweet on Mary and wants to help her, but, like, actually is helpful. Meanwhile, Ward, Jacqueline's husband, is just like, oh, I don't believe that murder took place. You know, it's, you know, whatever. Yeah.
It was interesting. It, like, because Ward kind of personified what the leading kind of the leading romantic guy was in the 40s, you know, and he, do you think like the studio kind of was like, all right, you got to have a romance, but it's got to be with this guy. Like the guy was, my wife pointed out, it's the dad on Leave It to Beaver. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we both thought he looked familiar, and then we made that connection about halfway through, but you know, you could, I don't know if he came off as charming as they intended.
Well, so it's weird because if we're going to get a little bit more into the, like the themes of it, Jacqueline, it's revealed. So she's married to this guy that it was a secret, and she's unhappy and comes across as suicidal. As she's being suicidal and whatever, she feels trapped in her life. So the husband, Ward, literally, he rents out a room, an apartment for her, and the apartment has a noose and a chair in it. So if she ever wants to end things, she can. She has the right to do it, I guess.
And that's it. Whole apartment with just that.
Ward is explaining this to Mary, and Mary's like concerned, obviously. And he's like, no, she's not going to do it. Just she wants to be able to have that option. So it's a little, I would say that whole, all that's like absurd, but like, I think it has a, I'm trying to think of the right way to say this, but it has a great sympathy for Jacqueline and being unhappy in life and what it's like to be someone who is depressed.
I think it's a striking metaphor for anybody that, you know, deals with thoughts like that on a regular basis. You know, it's instead of it always being a thought in the back of your mind, it's a physical place for her that she can go to anytime she wants. She's the only one that has access to it, you know, and I thought that was really interesting. I thought that was a really just powerful kind of image throughout the film.
Yeah. So one of the things that as you kind of dig into the themes a little bit, Jacqueline, I think on several occasions, it's hinted at that she is not straight. There are a few characters that the way they talk about Jacqueline, it leads one to believe that they were intimate with her. So part of it, it's interesting because it's not a, of the time period, it isn't like anything like meant to seem insidious or judgmental. So obviously I think that's positive, but also kind of the limitations there are, it can only be slightly coded way of presenting this information because the production code of the time would not allow them to go any further on that.
Do you think that was a combination of, you know, the production code as well as the limited runtime? Because it was yeah, kind of implied, but you know, that was another thing that didn't feel like it was fully developed, kind of like the romantic subplot.
Yeah. So I think that's accurate because in some ways it's like the satanic cult is the thing that's going to get you in the door. But really the satanic cult is only incidental as it being a group that Jacqueline falls into because she's unhappy, because she's lost, because she wants to find something else that will make her feel whole.
Right.
And you have, you know, the husband that Ward, who's not really like, he cares about her, but again, like he came off very controlling to me. And he's like searching for her. She has the satanic cult she goes to. She sees a therapist, and the therapist is wildly inappropriate, it seems, with her. that I don't know, because it's a lot of these things are inferred, it's hard to tell if there was actually a relationship there or if he was actively pursuing a relationship and that's why she didn't trust him. But it's interesting, so the cult wants to murder her because she went to the therapist and revealed their secrets, and by their like bylaws they need to murder the person who like reveals their secrets. But
and she was the seventh person in the cult to do this, thus the title The Seventh Victim.
Yes. Right. Yes. So they've done this six times before, but this by this point the membership has become a group of Greenwich Village weenies who seem to want to just, I don't know, like play house with like their satanic cult, where it's like they just dress up a lot and have little meetings about how like how it's cool to be evil, and they seem very like upset about the idea that they have to kill her because they want to be nonviolent, which I would think the easy answer is just don't kill her. Like,
right,
you know,
it's like they love the idea of being evil, but they're all kind of like, no, I don't really want to be evil today, guys.
I don't know. So this leads to a kind of funny moment where they present her with like a cup that has poison in it, and they're like, just drink it, you know, please drink it. And she's like, I don't want to drink it. And they're like, come on. No, but like they say to her, like, well, you're suicidal anyway. Can't you just drink it so we don't have to kill you?
They're just trying to get off the hook. They're like, yeah. I mean, we all know. Come on.
Oh, you're mean.
And that's when she actually, it seems like she's about to do it when the other cult member, who it's implied that she had an intimate relationship with, the other female, she stops her.
Yeah, so Frances knocks the cup out of her hand, and then she says something to the effect of she loved working with her or something to that effect.
She kept it very professional.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, I see you, 1940s. Wink, wink. I get what you're saying. I'm picking up what you're putting down. And, you know, so Jacqueline leaves and they say that they're gonna find her and kill her. And I think it leads to what is probably maybe the best sequence of the movie, which is she's walking down the alley. It's very dark, and there's a man that's following her. She loses him, right? And then at one point, she's getting scared, and she kind of leans up against a brick wall, and then she moves her hand over like a corner, and she touches the coat of the guy who has who pulls out a knife and tries to kill her.
Right.
And I think that was a very pretty impactful scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's interesting because thematically it's, you know, you have someone who is depressed, unhappy in life, but she's like struggling to not be killed. And like, she's actively making the choice to fight and get away from this guy. And, you know, I thought that was, I don't know, I related to that. And that at the end, when she ultimately makes the decision to go into her apartment and then kill herself, I think in kind of trying to contextualize it as an older film dealing with depression and stuff, I do see it's a story of a woman trying to take agency over her own life and her choosing to end it as opposed to letting someone else end her life. I do think there is some, you know, vague sense of empowerment to the story.
Wasn't there, there's a quote earlier, I'm probably botching it, it was she said something to the extent of, you know, life wasn't worth living if you couldn't end it on your own terms or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So yeah, that's, you know, she ultimately does end it on her own terms, and there's an interesting juxtaposition of her neighbor who's renting the next door apartment.
And I think hear her throughout the whole movie. She's just coughing in the background.
Yeah, it's revealed that she's terminal. She has a terminal illness, and she has a brief exchange with Jacqueline towards the end, where, you know, she's afraid of death, and, you know, Jacqueline's somebody who's not afraid of death and kind of embraces it. And this neighbor character is kind of gearing up to go, kind of have one last night on the town, mm-hmm. essentially, before, you know, this illness takes a hold of her. So, you know, the film ends as she's leaving to kind of go out and enjoy that night. And, you know, we hear Jacqueline end up hanging herself.
I wouldn't even say this type of stuff is really discussed very openly until maybe the 1970s, you know, at least. So especially like anything related to mental health and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I do think that there is just a sensitivity expressed there in a way for like a movie that's like a B horror movie, that it does bring out something that I think is kind of you know, maybe profound. I don't know.
It's interesting. I feel like a film with this subject matter would benefit from a runtime of longer than 75 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a movie, if you threw out the title Cat People, I'd be like, yeah, we should probably keep that under 75 minutes. But when you end up watching this and you discover the themes they're dealing with, you know, it's pretty heavy. And I think it's pretty profound. And I think it's something, you know, a lot of people grapple with, you know, not only people who deal with mental health issues, but, you know, also, you know, people grappling with their own mortality.
Yeah. And I think it's wrapping up like a heavy subject matter in a story that is meant to be a little bit more genre specific. So it's a way that allows you to deal with something heavy while also kind of making it easier for the audience to deal with these things.
Yeah. So Val Lewton kind of snuck these heavier themes into mm-hmm. what was supposed to just be a B horror movie. And, you know, B horror movie with a romantic subplot, you know, that's, he was probably given that and the title, and you know, it's
mm-hmm. that's why it's so bizarre though. The couple, Marion Ward, being like, hey, we love each other, right? And then she's like, mm-hmm. absolutely. And you're like, where did this come from?
Like, I was baffled by that. I was expecting her to be like, no, or like, I like the poet. And she was just like, yes, I love you too. I was like, what? That's really the moment when I felt like, you know, something.
I think that also is showing it's the dated aspect of it, just that.
Because he's the leading man, you know.
Yeah, of course.
He's the charming guy, you know.
Of course she would like him. And I was like, right. He was like a dipshit the whole movie. Like,
well, it's by today's standards, you know, I think.
He had a lot of oaf-like qualities.
And I don't think the poet character was supposed to be as endearing. He was just kind of like this nerdy, like, failed writer guy, where, like, nowadays, you know, that's the guy that the leading lady is going to fall in love with and realize mm-hmm. there's something deeper to him. And in the 40s, it was like, no, this guy's literally a loser. Like, he's not going to end up with the girl.
So, yo, this nerd isn't getting anywhere.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Jason.
But hold on. I do want to bring up the subplot of, so Jason and the therapist, Dr. Judd, have like some sort of weird mutual respect going on, that Dr. Mm-hmm. Judd really appreciates Jason's first book. And
yeah, he's a really big fan of it.
And it's like, it comes up out of nowhere, folks. And he's like, hey, when the Dr. Judd is kind of like, at this point in the movie, he's seen as more of an insidious character because you think he's a part of the cult or something. Apparently, actually, there was one of the scenes that was cut was Dr. Judd unsuccessfully trying to join the satanic cult, and they're like, no. And I'm just like, the cult is like, they're a bunch of like weenies. Like, how did you lose? Like,
that would have been an interesting scene.
So Jason and the Dr. Judd are talking and whatever, and then later on in the movie, Jason, with all that's going on with Mary and whatever, he gets inspired by what's happening and he starts writing again. His writer's block is gone. And he gives Dr. Judd a bunch of his writing. He's like, give this to your publisher. And then he goes, I will. I'm glad you're writing again. Anyway, back to this mystery. And here's the thing. All right. We're making fun of it. I kind of love it. Like, I'm like, oh, I want this like writer subplot happening. I'm into it.
It just seemed like I feel like, again, I know we were dealing with time limitations, but I feel like the movie just kept going and they kept introducing characters, and I'd be like, well, okay, guys, we are 30 minutes into a 70 minute film. Like, we are now 45 minutes into a 70 minute film. Like, I don't know. It just didn't, like, these are interesting characters in their own right, but I would have liked to see a little more time with some of them.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And I think that I think that it would have been better if they could have condensed some of the characters, or that if you're introduced to a character who forwards the plot along, that they like leave the story, like they're done. In this movie, it's like they keep accumulating male characters that are obsessed with Jacqueline, and then they're like, hey, so like you have the poet, Jason, talking to Mary, and he's like, actually, Mary, don't leave. I think we can help Jacqueline. And she's like, oh, really? What should we do? He goes, let's call her husband. Then the husband shows up and he goes, you know what I think we can do? Let's talk to Dr. Judd. So then they get Dr. Judd, and then they're like, they're all together again. And like, what do we do? He's like, I think I know where Jacqueline is. Hey, Jacqueline, we're ready to help you now. The gang is all here. So
it's this interesting combination of like profound and silly. I thought it's what we were discussing earlier, before we started recording, the ending where the psychiatrist, Dr. Judd, he kind of recites the Lord's Prayer
to the cult.
To kind of show them the error of their ways. And there's kind of this moment where they're like, yeah, we forgot about that prayer. You're right. Like, it's just like nowadays, you know, the cults give a little more pushback than that kind of somber response to the Lord's Prayer.
Well, it's like, so it's probably partially the code, production code at the time, but also it's just funny that like, we were also talking about how like people that are like satanic, it's not about like them being like, we're the evil guys here, you know, like they're more like invested in like self-interest, and like it's not about they see themselves as the bad guys or evil, but because it's like a satanic cult in the 1940s, it's like, hey, who's to say if good or evil is better, right? And it's like, well, I'm pretty sure no evil person ever thinks that they're evil. So that's a it's a weird thing to say.
Well, and they also like they don't like to kill people. They only kill people if they reveal details about the cult. So it's like in their mind, it's like, you know, you're forcing our hand to kill these six and now seven-ish people.
All right. So, Jason, do you have any other thoughts, or do you want to move on to...
This is just a random thought. When Mary first gets to New York and goes to the Dante's restaurant, when she's looking for Jacqueline, the one owner of the restaurant or the cook or whoever he is just dismisses her instantly. He says, this is a restaurant. Like, we see a lot of people in here. Of course we haven't seen your sister. And then like 30 seconds later, she's like, oh no, she's like a tall, beautiful girl. And he's like, oh, why didn't you say so? She's renting a room upstairs. Like that quick pivot kind of cracked me up.
I will also say, so I do think this is a very good scene, but the way that it's like kind of presented is a little kooky with how long they like try to play the scene out a little bit too long for like suspense. But so Mary sees the private investigator, Irving August. He gets stabbed when he goes into this one room, at this cosmetic business.
Yeah. We haven't really even talked about him, that the sad sack that got killed halfway through, incidentally by Jacqueline, because she was being held prisoner and she was just defending herself.
I love the like, of that era where you just have like a kind of a private investigator who's just like, oh, there's a crime, let me help you. And
I like how you like immediately after Mary reported to the police that her sister was missing, he just like strolls up to the counter. He's like, hey pal, let me see that missing persons file. And he's like, here you go.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like nowadays you gotta show some ID or fill out a lot more paperwork than that.
The part that I really enjoyed though was when he goes into the locked room, he unlocks it, he goes in, and he comes out and he's been stabbed.
That's one of the more suspenseful scenes, I would say, in the whole film.
So
halfway through.
I love that. And Mary runs off, and we see her, she gets in the subway and she's like traumatized. So she's sitting on the subway. It kind of loops back around. And I think someone, one of the people that works in the subway, like references that she's been sitting there for a long time. So it loops back around and goes back. And then you see two people walk in with like, you know, looking shady. And between them is clearly the body of August.
And yeah, some like Weekend at Bernie's type of. Like,
so they're dragging a body. They're dragging the body with him like he's like maybe he's drunk or had too much. And he's got a hat covering his face. And they sit down with him and he's clearly, you know, dead. And it looks exactly like August. So, and yeah. It's from the subway stop that she came from before. And the movie plays it though a little too long where she's staring. She's like, something's up here.
Yeah, it, like the reveal takes a long time. Yeah, it's like she's
and
she's not startled until she sees his face.
Yeah, the hat isn't it? The hat falls off or something.
Yeah, the hat is they either tilt it up accidentally or and then you see it's his face. It's not weird enough to her that you know this guy who is at least passed out is being dragged onto the subway. They did make quick work out of that though. Like if she left there immediately.
Yeah.
Got on the subway and they were right behind her, like,
yeah,
with a body.
So it's weird though, because like the way it was played, I didn't think that they were going to have a part where there's like a reaction reality to it. I thought it was just going to be her like internally. Like acknowledging that
like
this
she had already realized that how is she going to get away?
Yeah, and that she's trying not to, you know, arise suspicion or something. Instead, that's not how it's played. As soon as she sees it, she's like, oh, I better leave.
She draws a lot of attention to herself in that moment.
And then she runs out. Good instincts on the scene in terms of, like, the setup. But the execution is a little goofier than needed to be. But I still kind of loved it.
Yeah.
It's like, because it's the right amount of silly.
Yeah.
That makes it fun. So
I agree. Yeah.
Any other thoughts, Jason? Do you have anything else you want to bring up?
I guess we'll kind of end with this. John, would you join this cult?
Absolutely, Jason.
Wow. That was no hesitation.
No hesitation. Here's why.
Yeah, please. I'm excited to hear these details.
All right. So the main guy in charge of the cult. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I am about 99% sure that within 2 months of me joining that cult, I would be the leader of that cult because I would just have to give him a gigantic wedgie. He would say, okay, you're the leader now. It's fine. And that'd be great. I'd be on easy street.
Incidentally, that the film The Eighth Victim deals with the aforementioned wedgie.
It would be so easy.
By the way, I pulled up RKO Pictures on Wikipedia, and in the right column where it kind of condenses the details about the company, it says industry, motion pictures, fate, bankrupted. I really think we need to keep the fate thing going in all Wikipedia entries. Just fate. Like...
Well, if we ever have Wikipedias ourselves,
let's take a stab at it. Fate. 2 episodes.
Oh my God. All right. Well, Jason, would you have joined this cult?
I'm going to go no.
Well, man, but it's so appealing, right? Like,
I mean, if you were in charge, maybe I would consider it because I know you'd kind of be open to whatever I wanted to do.
Listen, Jason, if I'm in charge, there are going to be some bitching wine and cheese parties.
I know that you would not run a tight ship if you ran a cult. I would change it to a maybe if I knew you were in charge. But yeah, I'm going to go with no, just the satanic aspects. You know, we touched in episode 1. Not a big fan of exorcisms, so I feel like I make myself more susceptible if I end up in a satanic cult. So I'm gonna avoid this one. We'll see what the future episodes have to offer.
Well, vote for John for this satanic cult.
I do agree that you could take over the cult. I mean, yeah. he was pretty easily influenced by the Lord's Prayer. So as long as you got that in your back pocket, I think you could take it over.
I would just say, listen, guys, we're going to have a 50% reduction in human sacrifices. And they're like, oh, thank God. We didn't want to do that. It wasn't even fun for us. We just like the
down
wine
with that at all.
We really like the wine and cheese parties. Check out the spread, John. Thank God. I mean, thanks, Satan. All right. So, well, I think that about does it for this week's episode.
So, what are we hitting on next week?
So, next week, we will be reviewing Rosemary's Baby. Which...
Excellent.
It should be a good time. We will... I think that'll be a fun one. That was... I actually saw... My mom showed me that... Of course.
Of course she did. Yeah, right after Die Hard.
Yes, my mom showed this to me when I was young. And it was
She's
scary.
Like, we almost did with this with you, John, but we changed our mind.
Actually,
be grateful.
Do you know what she told me? Like, this is the truth. After she rewatched The Omen after I was born, I guess apparently when I was not happy about certain things like going to bed early or something, that I would give a little bit of a look that was similar to like the devil kid Damien and The Omen. Yeah. So they checked. She literally checked my head for like the 3/6 to see like, oh, maybe he is the the son of the devil. Maybe that happened.
You can't be too careful. I know I gave a silly impression of your mom. I adore your mother. Hello, Fran.
Yeah,
she's a very sweet woman.
You
can't be too careful. I might have checked myself. I don't know.
But yeah, so all right. Well, anyway, you know, if you guys like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe. We don't know how many people are listening to the show. We hope it gets to a wider audience. I don't know. One key fact though, if you hate the show, please send Jason threatening emails because all of the things you hate about the show, it's actually his fault, not mine. All right, guys. Have a good week, everyone.
All right. Stab you later.